I'm Jessica Harris, and welcome to my welcome table. I'm going to be at the welcome table. Gather round this special table. It's scarred with memories, pitted with burn spots from hot skillets, and decorated with moisture rings from frosty glasses of lemonade, beer bottles, bourbon and ginger ale, and untold goblets of red wine. This table will be our flying carpet as we travel around the world. I'll share some of my secret spots. We'll meet new friends and reconnect with old ones. Sometimes, the table will be covered with fine Porthot linen and my mother's bone china, and we'll sup on caviar and champagne. Other times, we'll cover it with yesterday's news and hanker down for a crawfish boil or a lobster supper. Whatever the meal, by the end of our time together, we'll have shared some special friends, sacred spots, and the food, drink, and music that connects them. So come, join me at my welcome table.
Hi, my name's Mitzi Pratt, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
I am Patrick Dunn, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is Nathan Drews, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is John Barkley, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is Anne McBride, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
Compass Point, 32 degrees 46 minutes north, 79 degrees 55 minutes west, Charleston, South Carolina. It was 1983, and I was trying to be a good scholar, but Charleston had long been on my lists of cities to visit, so I went over the wall. Now, it's a fairly long drive from Columbia to Charleston, but my friends and I had never been to the city that houses Catfish Row, and we were determined that we'd see it during the College Language Association Conference. After all, some of us would never have journeyed to the South Carolina Conference if we hadn't fallen for the lure of the place that some call the Holy City. So we all hauled into a car and hit the road, forsaking panels on multiculturalism and deconstructing the works of Haitian author Jacques Roumain. We were Charleston bound. We talked and drove. It was mainly highway, but out of the car window I could see the changing landscape as we entered the Lowcountry. I stared out of the windows, mesmerized by its density, and thought of the snakes and gators and other unspeakable critters that lived in the swampy lands, and wondered what the Africans enslaved in the Lowcountry must have thought of the palmetto forests and marshy terrain. Finally, we drove into the center of the town. We drove by curious houses with front doors that led to seemingly nowhere porches that looked a little bit like the buildings that I'd seen on trips to Barbados. The colors were entrancing, as were the star-shaped earthquake bolts on some of the older buildings. Soon, we were in the center of town and parked near the market where in the 17th to 19th centuries enslaved Africans hawked wares and carried on lively commerce. A circa 1900 postcard that I'd later purchase described it as low shed-light structures running down the center of Market Street from Meeting Street to East Bay. It was Charleston's market, and there not only provisions but many other things could have been purchased. The 20th century postcard added, "It's a weird place to visit at night, but a scene long to be remembered." We had no idea where to eat, and so just headed into the first place that we saw. As it turned out, it was most assuredly not one of Charleston's finest places, but we'd made our pilgrimage and had to get back and do our presentations, and weren't leaving without a meal. We ordered, and the waitress asked if we'd like rice or potatoes. Now, I've never been a real potato person, so I said rice, but was surprised when everyone else said rice as well. And we were all delighted when it came to find that it was Charleston's own red rice, fluffy, flecked with bits of bell pepper, and red with tomato. We dipped in forks and said virtually in unison, Chebujin. We'd all spent time in Senegal, and our mouths told us what I'd later confirmed through research. The food of South Carolina's low country is closely related to that of the rice-growing regions of Western Africa, and those regions include southern Senegal. Charleston's red rice, in fact, is indeed a variation on the red rice served with vegetables and fish that is the national dish of Senegal. I've returned to Charleston many times and now number it among my favorite places. I've had grand meals there in fancy restaurants and with newly made and long-standing friends on kitchen tables. None, though, has informed me as much as my first one, where I learned to trust my taste buds. It was in Charleston that I learned when I sit down at a meal, be it grand or humble, I should relax, taste, and always be prepared to have a culinary epiphany. Little did I know then, but on my very first trip that lasted only a few hours, I'd already found my way into Charleston and the Lowcountry and its culture through its history, which is rich with food. Charleston has always been a special place for people who study African culture in the hemisphere. It is one of the earliest towns in the continental United States where African life was a fact of life early on. By the end of the 17th century, visitors commented on the city's African appearance and the fact that blacks outnumbered white. One early visitor wrote, "How strange the aspect of this city. Every street corner and door still filled with blacks. Blacks driving the drays and carriages, blacks carrying burdens, blacks tending children and vending articles on the sidewalks, blacks doing it all." The cultivation of the Low Country's major agricultural products, rice, indigo, and long staple cotton, was based on a task system. That system allowed the enslaved to use their time free after their tasks were accomplished as their own. Many of the enslaved raised vegetables on small plots of land to supplement their rations and to trade with their masters for privileges and even cash. It would be those African underpinnings of the city and its culture that fascinated me on my first visit and still fascinate me today. None more so than the city's lengthy history of street vendors. At the beginning of Act 2, Scene 3 of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, a woman strolls across the stage, her plangent call signaling daybreak over Catfish Row. The strawberry woman's cry is followed by that of the honey man and the crab seller as the community emerges to face the morning. With these haunting street cries, librettist Du Bois Hayward and composer George Gershwin celebrated a tradition of Charleston's past. The street vendor. Vendors, like those who inspired Haywood and Gershwin's Strawberry Woman, were fixtures in Charleston's neighborhoods for more than three centuries.
I'm talking about devil crabs. I'm talking about devil crabs. I'm talking about the food ourselves. She crabs. Devil crabs. I'm talking about the food ourselves.
While today's Charlestonians may make a quick hop to Harris Teeter or Piggly Wiggly for their produce and seafood, years ago, their victuals were delivered by street vendors who brought their wares in baskets that were carried on their heads or over their arms. The vendors roamed the neighborhoods, each singing a specific cry in the melodic Gullah dialect that extolled their goods. The street vendors were so much a part of the city's character that they were constantly mentioned by travelers and illustrated by local and visiting artists who invoked the ghosts of Charleston's pasts. One of the recent evocations was by the late American gastronome Johnny Apple in an article on the Low Country for the New York Times. He reminded readers that his wife Betsy, who was a native of the region, could recall vendors crying out, "Shwimpy, Shwimpy," when she was very young. He lamented, though, that they had disappeared along with most of the sweet, tiny creek shrimp that they sold. Old etchings show the various Parisian vendors, hot chocolate sellers, chestnut vendors, notion peddlers, and others. The cries of the Dublin streets are remembered in the folk song Molly Malone, who sold cockles and mussels alive, alive-o. And London vendors were immortalized more recently in the musical Oliver with the round Who Will Buy? But Charleston street vendors and their cries were different, offering a new world twist on an old world theme. The main distinction of the selling calls of this hemisphere is an African influence. An African influence that is seen in most of the urban areas of the American South where the vendors were of African descent. Freedmen, newly emancipated, and even enslaved, they brought with them a wit, a verve, and an ingenuity to marketing their wares that was all their own. Now, market women have long been a tradition on the African continent. In regions of the continent's west coast, these strong, industrious women held not only power of the purse, but wielded considerable political power as well. In the 20th century, they've even toppled governments and worked with independence movements. In earlier times, they were the region's economic foundation. Many of these women, though, worked in traditional, well-organized markets, and itinerant vendors seem not to have had a really large effect. But in the New World, higglers, as the vendors are called in the English-speaking Caribbean, began to have an enormous influence on the market early on. In the first quarter of the 18th century, Barbadian planters found themselves inundated with slaves, street vendors, and passed a series of laws designed to limit or quell the entrepreneurial zeal of the women. Huckstering, as it was known, became so endemic that it was made punishable by law. Nonetheless, there were those who engaged in it. They included specialists, often domestics, who sold on the street, but on their owner's account. Other hucksters worked independently, and candy vendors were prominent among them. An early observer wrote, "We also see at the corner of almost every street women sitting on little stools and sometimes on the ground with a tray containing sugar or ginger cakes." From 1708 onward, increasingly repressive laws outlawed the practice of slave huckstering, but planters finally had to acknowledge the inevitable, and legalized slave vending in Barbados began in the late 18th century. Certainly, these enslaved entrepreneurs were the first to provide door-to-door food delivery service to the good folks south of Broad. By 1800, the Charleston City Council had ordinances on the books regulating the age of slave vendors and the types of goods sold, milk, grain, fruit, victuals, and provisions of any kind. The city also issued annual badges or licenses to the sellers of fruits, cakes, and other items, and they cost a whopping $15, which was much higher than the licenses of fishermen, washerwomen, and even porters. But the Africans prevailed, and by 1823, letters to the editor of the Charleston Courier suggested that public cries should be regulated. The Negro should be taught to announce what he has to sell and to suppress his wit. In the aftermath of the Civil War, it was not inconceivable that many a former master and many a former slave banded together for survival, one growing, the other selling. By the turn of the 20th century, the door-to-door hucksters of Charleston were well in place, each with a distinctive song, from the shwimpy shwimpy of the shrimp man selling his freshly caught wares, to green peas, sugar peas of the vegetable mamas, as they were called, baskets in hand or on head, some sassy, others stately, they would all walk the streets and stop at the kitchen doorways, calling out their wares to the cooks. Others sold candies and delicacies like monkey meat, a coconut and molasses confection that was hawked by women near schools and around town. As recently as the 1950s, Charleston streets still rang to the cries of red rose tomatoes and watermelon, watermelon, and witty verses like porgy walk, porgy talk, porgy eat with a knife and fork, all extolled the virtues of the foods that were being peddled from door to door. Now, though, the streets are quiet, and all that remains is a memory and an occasional vendor like Tony the Peanut Man, who is a last reminder of the time when the freshest fruit, vegetables, and the freshest fish imaginable came with a rhyme and a rhythm and was as simple as poking a head out the kitchen door whenever somebody passed calling out, "I'm talking about the food I sells."
Now what I say, hey, ooh, got some ball and I got some toast, they got some food and I got some roast, oh yeah, peanut man, catch him if you can, got some heart and I got some cold, got some dig down to the oh yeah, peanut man, catch him if you can, cause he got the right one, baby.
No one knew the food history of Charleston better than John Martin Taylor, better known to culinary aficionados as Hoppin' John. For years, I've known him as Bubba. He must have asked me to call him Bubba about a decade or more ago, and I've enjoyed putting my feet under his table and listening to him talk about the food and the culture of the city he so loves. It's been 20 years since the publication of Hoppin' John's Low Country Cooking, his seminal work on the region's cooking. A 20th anniversary issue is scheduled for publication by the University of North Carolina Press, and I'm going to keep my old first edition on the shelf and get myself a new one. In years past, Hoppin' John's Charleston bookstore was a haunt of culinary bibliophiles. The shop has now closed, but the stone ground grits that he used to sell and the wisdom he dispensed in person is now dispensed via the internet from Bulgaria, where he is now relocated. He was one of the first to celebrate the city's unique culinary culture and the gullah tradition so beautifully depicted in the film Daughters of the Dust, that extraordinarily, hauntingly beautiful film by Julie Dash.
Outsiders call them Geechies or gullahs. They were different from other black Americans. They had their own culture and language. They had their own gods. Their world was changing. They had to move forward or cease to exist. The women were the carriers of their traditions and beliefs.
Bubba may have left Charleston, but the city's culinary aura continues to grow and evolve. Now, the city even celebrates its culinary culture and its chefs every March with the Charleston Wine and Food Festival. And you're not getting to Charleston, and you're not getting out of Charleston with having at least one dish of shrimp and grits. Shrimp and grits, the classic Lowcountry breakfast, is on the menu all day long in Charleston's restaurants like Husk, High Cotton, Hominy Grill, and others that build on the repertoire of rice-based dishes. Rice was the wealth of Charleston and the reason that many Africans were enslaved there. That is the sad underside of Charleston's history. And there is no better place of pilgrimage to learn about that underside than the Old Slave Mart Museum. There, under the able direction of curator Nicole Green, the story is told in several voices. That of the sellers, that of the buyers, and that of the sold, the enslaved Africans.
Oh, death is awful. Oh, death is awful. Oh, death is awful. Spare me over another year.
The experience is chilling, but informative, and all the more so when contrasted with the elegant in-town Aiken Wreck. And all the more so when contrasted with the elegant in-town Aiken. And all the more so when contrasted with the elegant in-town Aiken Rett, Nathaniel Russell, Joseph Manigo, and Haywood Washington houses, and the magnificence of plantations like Middleton and Drayton Hall. To anyone with a little more time to spend in Charleston, Drayton Hall offers a compelling view of plantation life. Although the rooms are unfurnished and stark, the docents vividly evoke the life of the house. They tell of the private lives of master and enslaved, and how they lived in close proximity. The slaved lived their lives in the courtyard behind the grand mansion, and there they washed clothes, cooked their meals, and raised their children. It is astonishing to learn just how intertwined their lives truly were. It was amazing, and it's also borne out in town in some of the historic houses there where kitchens and back houses were virtually a few steps away. But all of this historic musing is sure to make me thirsty, and so I head off to Charleston Place for brunch, where Miss Bonita and Miss Carnita Scott are sure to greet me with a warm smile and a bottle of pink bubbly. All too soon, though, it will be time to leave. I'm off to New York, but I leave with the sounds of the ghosts of the street callers of Charleston. I'm off to New York, but I leave with the sounds of the street vendors of Charleston echoing in my head.
Ma'am, I got flowers. You ask me how I sell them. Yes, ma'am, 10 cents a bunch, 3 for a quarter. Yes, ma'am, who got the money, come and buy. And who ain't got the money, sign the side and cry. Flowers to go and buy. What y'all looking after me so far?
And so, until next time.
I just come to let y'all know.
He must kill it good and greasy when I'm gone, gone, gone. He must kill it good and greasy when I'm gone. He must kill it good and greasy when I'm gone, gone, gone. He must kill it good and greasy when I'm gone.